And our guest in today's program is Nick Hornbuckle, currently resides in British Columbia, also a regular member of John Reichman and the Jaybirds. Nick has released a brand new album, 13 or so. Really, really talented banjo player. Enjoyable visit. You're going to like it a lot. Finally getting to talk to Nick. It's been a while. I've wanted to do this, and we finally connected across the continent. You're listening to Unreal Bluegrass. You just heard the title cut from Nick Hornbuckle's new album. Nick, first-time guest, how are you doing? I'm so happy to have you on the show today.
I'm doing really well, Steve. I really want to say that I appreciate very much your interest and you having me on your show. That means a lot to me.
Well, Nick, I've known you, and I've seen you before with John Reichman. I've seen you perform. I've always been a fan of your playing. The new album is all original tunes with some great musicians. We talked a little bit off the air about that. And you also have the album from 2014, which is entitled Nick Hornbuckle 12 by 2 plus or minus 1, which is more traditional. So you've made a change from that 2014 that these are all original things with original approaches that you have. I'm going to talk about some of them with you, and we'll get into the album a little bit, but I do appreciate your time.
My pleasure, absolutely.
Listen, every time I hear a tune like I think one we're going to cut to is Wellesley Station. We'll talk about that in a little bit. I have to look at the map again because I'm thinking, here's Nick in British Columbia, and I keep thinking, shouldn't this be over in Nova Scotia somewhere? This the sound of the music that you're playing. There's this Celtic, Irish, Scottish feel, and I'm thinking, where do you pick that up?
Well, you know, it's really, I don't know. It just really seriously just comes to me. I get these little blips and pieces of fragments of tunes, and then the hard part is putting them all together to make something that actually sounds like something. But, you know, I mean, my family immigrated from England in about 1540 or so. So I do have that kind of British Isle influence, but it's been a few generations back. But, you know, I absolutely love Irish and Scottish music, so it's not surprising that it's in there.
And you like to sample a lot of different music. I think on 30 or so is a really nice combination of just, by the way, beautiful, beautiful melodies. I will say this to you. I say this every time I talk to Alan Mundy, who is my personal favorite musician, banjo player. Not only do I admire Alan's style of playing, but his choice of notes and the melodies I just think are very pretty, and that's the term that I use to describe a lot of the melodies that you're putting forward. I don't think you mind being lumped in with Alan Mundy. He's the only other person I've said that about. Alan's choice of notes is just devastating to me.
You know, Steve, I just got to say, I absolutely do not mind being lumped in with Alan Mundy because he is one of my banjo heroes, too, for that very same reason. There's like, he's such a thoughtful guy, you know, that there's not a wasted note, and it all means something, which I really, really admire his playing and his approach.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he's just always has that sound, and you have a recognizable sound, and I will attach it again to this concept of maybe banjo players don't want to be pretty, but I think your melodies are really beautiful and pretty, and some of them are upbeat, but some of them do have that kind of Celtic, like the 11th tune on the album, which I would pronounce as either I haven't asked you this before, either Suki or how do you pronounce the 11th cut? Sooke.
It's Souk. It's a small little town on the southern coast of Vancouver Island.
Okay, I mean that has almost a Celtic feel to me, which I'm not trying to be too cute or clever because I just kind of get swept back into that sound in Ireland and that part of England. But again, beautiful, just a beautiful melody.
Well, you know, the thing to me about Irish music in particular is it just has this overwhelming sense of melancholy to it. It can be incredibly joyful music, but there's always this underlying sense of melancholy, which really speaks to me. And I can only imagine that's some sort of, you know, genetic echo from, you know, 500 years ago. But it's there, definitely, and I definitely hear that in that music. And, you know, I would like to think that some of that might come through in some of the music that I write as well. So,
well, I think it does. And when you compare it to the 12 by 2 You can do traditional. You have your own feel for those things, but you can do the traditional sound, and there are all traditional songs on that except for the one, which I think you co-wrote. But on 30 or so, you wrote them. You joined in with some great musicians, by the way. I want to give a little bit of acknowledgement. John Reichman, I know of. I've heard the Jaybirds. I know, and I've seen you with that band. But there's a lot of great players, and there's an awful lot of them they have to mention. But we talked a little bit off the air about the banjo player that joined you on the second cut on the album, South Road.
Yeah, his name is Chris Cool, and he's a really amazingly great clawhammer-style banjo player who lives up in over in Toronto. And he plays in a band called the Lonesome A String Band, and I really encourage everyone who might listen to this to check those guys out, because they are really powerful, really great.
The dobro player, I also don't know, Ivan Rosenberg. I'm really impressed with his playing throughout this, and you can tell us more about him, because I think we need to give credit to those people that join in.
Oh, you know, absolutely. I on my website, I have there's liner notes, sort of, you know, little stories about the tunes or whatever, but I also give credit to all the musicians and have their contact information, because, you know, without these musicians, it wouldn't be anywhere near what it is. So, but anyway, so Ivan is a really great dobro player who lives in Toronto also, and he's really kind of known in the dobro world. He's regularly hired for all the big music camps, and he has a duo with Chris Cool, and does a lot of session work. He's got a studio up there, and he's a very lyrical player, and I'm sure that, as you noticed in that tune that we mentioned, Fleetwood's Ford, his playing is just absolutely beautiful.
Oh, geez. It really is.
And, you know, I can't remember, it might be in the liner notes where I sort of say that my take on it is that it's almost like Mark Knopfler, in terms of it's just really beautiful, and there's great melody to it and lots of interesting space, and it just is very, very, very musical, you know.
You've mentioned a couple times your website. People can find the 30 or so album there. You also do, not so much inside the album because there's not enough room, but on your website, which I think if they just look for Nick Hornbuckle, they could find it. Is that fair?
Yeah, just nickhornbuckle.com.
Yeah, you go into more, a paragraph or more description of the tunes, and you do discuss more in the players for that, so hopefully people will find that. You also have, because you sent me, to which I will work on, I promise, you sent me tablature for, I'm going to do it, and I'll let you know when I've mastered one of these, not that that'll happen, but you sent me a copy of a tablature. Now, you have tablature for a lot of your recordings on there, and they're available for people to obtain, but sometimes people don't know what tablature is or what it's supposed to be. It comes up every once in a while in discussions here on Unreal Bluegrass, but try to explain a little bit to the average person that might want to get into banjo playing what that is and how it can be useful.
Sure. Well, standard notation is something that you would read if you were playing the piano or the flute or the violin. And tablature is similar to standard notation, but in a lot of respects, it's quite different. And the main reason that it's different is that it shows you exactly where to put your fingers, both right and left hand. Like, it'll indicate to play the fourth string at the fifth fret with the thumb. So it's very literal. It really tells you exactly what to do. And one of the benefits to that is, you know, there are tab books that feature all different players. And, for instance, I know that several years ago, John Lawless did a book on J.D. Crow.
Yep.
And it can be really helpful to actually see how J.D. is actually playing this stuff instead of what you might think he's doing.
Yeah, I mean, it's an instant visual thing. Now, I think that all players like you don't want people to become reliant upon it. And I'm talking to Nick Hornbuckle, if you're just tuning in to Unreal Bluegrass. But it's a great place to start. It's a great place, and the timing is kind of, you can spread the notes out whereas the fingers are, so you can get a better sense of the timing if you haven't heard the tune, although I would recommend to learn the tablature for 30 or so that you also have the album so you can hear the timing as it relates to what's in front of them on the page.
Right, yeah, absolutely. You know, it's really interesting thing to me is that I started playing banjo when I was about 11 years old, and this was in, like, 1973. I'm actually that old. And I could not figure out tablature to save my life. My mom subscribed me to Banjo Newsletter, and they have all kinds of tab in there, and I just could not make it make sense. And so I ended up basically teaching myself by listening to slowed down Earl Scruggs records, you know, Flat and Scruggs, J.D. Crowe and Alan Bundy, Alan Shelton. And it was much later that I actually figured out, you know, I'm not the sharpest knife in the drawer. It took me a while to put together the notes on the page with the notes I was hearing. And this is completely tangential, but it's really interesting to me that nowadays there's so much information available. I mean, when I started to play, I literally had a Flat and Scruggs record, a record player that would go to 16, and a picture of Earl Scruggs.
Kind of your shrine.
That's what I had. And now you can go online and see footage of Scruggs playing.
Oh, those are cool. You know, those like, Martha White shows are so cool.
Oh, they're the best, and it is so educational watching him play because it is as easy to him as falling off a log.
Yep.
And I think that having that kind of attitude about it is immeasurably helpful. Because, I mean, a person can make anything as hard as they want to, but if you watch a guy like Earl Scruggs play, it's like, it's actually pretty easy. I mean, it's not. It's really hard. But if you have that attitude that it's easy, it makes it easier to do it, I think.
I think so. I love those videos that you're talking about. I think probably, so then I started a little bit later than you, and I immediately had the Earl Scruggs book that Bill Keith wrote the tablature for. And then Tony Trischka wrote the melodic banjo thing sometime in the mid-70s, and that kind of gave you a little bit of a look into some other players. And I think that Sonny Osborne had a book way back when. Pete Seeger, I guess, if you really want to look way, way back to somebody's approach to playing.
Yeah.
A whole different style of playing than what Earl did. But they were all tablature-based, the reason I bring them up. And it's I'm glad that you keep doing that so that someone can just discover banjo. If they're 11 or 12 or 13 or 14 and they discover Nick Hornbuckle and they can say, hey, I can see this on paper to give me a better vision of what I'm trying to accomplish, just to get them a little further along, I think it would be nice for people to know that.
Yeah, well, you know, one other guy that I really feel should be mentioned because not only have a personal connection to me, but also in the sense of how he was really one of the first guys put out a tab book is Pete Wernick.
Absolutely. I did not mean to not mention Dr. Banjo.
No.
Huge friend. Yep.
Of course not. Yeah. I mean, and his, I actually checked his book out from the library after I kind of was able to put two and two together, and it was really helpful. And, you know, one of the things I thought was super cool was that his tab looked like it was all written by hand. I thought, this is kind of cool.
And Pete is one of the most giving people in music. He will stop and help anyone, and we're getting way off here, man. Nick, but this is good to know. I'm glad to connect. I'm glad to connect with you on these points because I feel the same way about these things. But Pete, you couldn't find a better intro into music and someone who will help. You see him around younger people playing. He'll just stop and say, hey, you know, do this or try this. Very, very helpful guy. But anyway, let's talk about you and 30 or so. We talked a little bit about Fleetwood's Ford, which is absolutely beautiful, and Ivan absolutely tears up the dobro, and that really brings you into the song. The Crooked Man tune you and I talked a little bit about before we went on air. I want to talk about that, then I want to take a break, and I want you to steer us into one of the tunes, but tell me a little bit about The Crooked Man, which is the third cut on 30 or so.
Okay, well, I wrote that tune when I lived for many years in Seattle, and when I wrote the tune, I think my daughter Cleo was probably two or three, and so we were reading all of the all of the little kids' books. And, you know, we read The Crooked Man. I thought, man, that's a tune title. That's really kind of cool. And so I, at that point, had just kind of started experimenting with alternate tunings on the banjo. And one of the alternate tunings, which I really like, is this sort of, I call it a modal tuning. I don't know what other people call it, but it's where you are in regular G tuning, but you raise your second string, your B string, up to a C. And it gives it that kind of really unresolved, kind of spooky mountain sound, like, you know, like Clinch Mountain Backstep. It's got that sound. And I just kind of started monkeying around in that tuning, and, I mean, the tune just appeared. You know, I mean, it took some work to put it into final shape, but on the record, it's a full band arrangement. The Jaybirds actually recorded that tune, I think it might have been on our second record, or just with John and me. John was playing mandolin, and I was playing banjo. And when I was putting together this album, I was thinking, that tune is really kind of cool, and it's kind of a modal, I don't want to get too highfalutin, but it's kind of a modal tone poem. It's just kind of a very interesting sound. And so I thought, well, it'd be interesting to re-record it with the full band, because it never had that before. And one other thing that I want to say is that 3 or 4 years ago, we played at the Fresh Grass Festival in North Adams, Massachusetts. And one of the other bands there was Ricky Skaggs and Kentucky Thunder. And the way that their sound guy had the sound mixed, the bass was just amazing. And I thought, I want to have a bass like that on a tune of mine, because it's just so, it just kicks your behind.
Thank you for that. Thank you for keeping that clear. I like it. We talked off the air that it struck me as I kept feeling some Clinch Mountain thing in there. There's no lost backsteps anymore. I think he evened it out. So that's cool. Hey, listen, you mentioned your daughter Cleo reading a book. I want you to talk about Cleo Bell, because there's some really cool Chinese stuff which banjo players just salivate over. Then I want you to lead us into a tune for our first break. Talk a little bit about Cleo Bell.
Okay, well, Cleo Bell is a tune that I wrote for my daughter Cleo when we first moved to Vancouver Island. We had some family who lived here, and they introduced us to this amazing swimming hole. And at the time, Cleo was 5, and, you know, she hadn't had swimming lessons, and it's a little sketchy for me to have her at the swimming hole, but she's my favorite person right now. She's 19 now, of course, but at the time she was 5, and she taught herself how to swim at the swimming hole. And after I wrote the tune and incorporated the chimes into it, I kind of realized that, well, if you kind of close your eyes, think a little bit about it, you could imagine that the chimes were the sound of her splashing in the water. Which, you know, when I play that tune, and I've played it countless times, and I love playing it every time because it reminds me of her and how much I love her. So we had talked earlier about the actual construction of the tune, and one of the things that I sometimes do is set myself a job. And with that particular tune, I wanted to write a banjo tune where the lowest note in the melody was not apparent right away, if that makes sense. And so in double C tuning, the lowest note is a C on the fourth string. And that doesn't appear until quite a ways into the tune. And it was, you know, just kind of a challenge to me, if that makes sense.
It does.
And I, like I say, I really like playing the tune, and one of the interesting things about the tune is that it's got all of the what I call the Beatle chords in it, especially in the B part where the chimes are. I mean, it's got all the different chords you would play in the key of C.
Okay.
And, you know, it's kind of funny that one time several years ago, we were playing at the Grass Valley Festival for the CBA, and I have this really great fiddler who was originally from California, but now lives in Nashville, I believe, Megan Lynch was sitting in with us.
I love Megan.
We were going to play this. Yeah, she's great. Oh, she's great. And we were going to play this tune, and we didn't have time to run it down. And she was saying, well, what can you tell me about it? And I said, well, it's in the key of C, and it's got all the Beatle chords. She's like, okay, I got it.
Yeah, she could do that.
Yeah. Oh, of course, yeah.
She has the strongest right hand. I mean, you talk about fiddle players, it'll just blow you away. I know her well over the years, and I love her playing. I love her playing.
Yeah,
she got it right away.
Oh, of course. Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, there's in that tune, there's nothing that's really super outside. And, I would like to think that it kind of makes sense. That when you kind of check it out, you go, yeah, okay, this kind of fits. It's like it fits together. Makes sense instead of like, hmm.
Sounds like it fits together. Nick, I want you to lead us into a little break here. I think you're going to lead us into the first cut on the album, which we discussed off the air, but lead us into Wellesley Station, and we'll play that, and we'll come back and chat some more with Nick Hornbuckle. Tell us a little bit about that, and we'll cut right to that.
Sure. Great. Thanks, Steve. So Wellesley Station is a tune that's named after the little town in North Idaho where my mother was born. And it's also, coincidentally, happens to be a stop on the Toronto subway. So it's not named for the Toronto subway. It's a little town in North Idaho.
Okay.
But it's in double C tuning, capo 2, so it's in key of D. And as you had observed, it's got a certain sort of Celtic feel to it, which, you know, I absolutely love Irish and Scottish music. One of the things I had mentioned earlier is that one of the things about that music that really strikes me is that there's a ton of joy and happiness in it too, but there's also a real sense of melancholy and longing, and that really resonates with me. It's not like super depressing music at all. It's very joyful, but there's definitely a sense of melancholy in it. And so I hope that some of that comes through in some of the music that I write. And when it comes to Wellesley Station, there's this B part has a triplet in it, which is kind of that's a totally signature Irish thing to do. So I'm completely shameless in stealing.
Well, I love the tune, and all those things you said are absolutely accurate about it. Let's play for the listening audience. Wellesley Station. We'll be right back with Nick Hornbuckle on Unreal Bluegrass. First time, hopefully not the last. We'll be right back. There you just heard Wellesley Station, as led into very well by Nick Hornbuckle, who ought to be able to. He wrote it, recorded it, told you the story behind it. Nick's my guest on Unreal Bluegrass today. We're talking about many things, but we started out wanting to talk about his brand new album, 30 or so. And we've been doing a lot of that. We've been talking about a lot of different musical things, and I've enjoyed every second of it so far, Nick. I hope you're having a good time getting to explain some of these things.
Absolutely. I'm glad that you're enjoying it, because as I mentioned earlier, I can go on the oddest tangents, and you've managed to keep me fairly close to the subject matter.
Well, there's 12 cuts on here, and we've already mentioned they're available on your website, which is easy. Sometimes I have guests that say, but you have to spell it this way. If you spell it the other way, there's only one Nick Hornbuckle that I Googled to find all these things. So that'll work. That works good for you. I love your playing, and I love the choice. 12 tunes on here. When you're writing tunes, you're probably always writing tunes. How do you pick the 12? I've had people say, well, it was the first 12 we had. But how do you some of these tunes go back a ways as far as inspiration. How do you choose to get down to the 12 that then become what we're talking about here, the 13 or so album?
Man, you know, that's really a good question. Years ago, I played in a rock and roll band in Seattle, and we recorded everything. We wrote original music, and we eventually had like 80 tunes and songs. And I'm a really big believer in recording everything, you know, even if it's just a fragment or an A part or a B part or something, because you never know when the ability to write is going to dry up. So picking these 12 tunes was kind of a challenge, because I literally have 60 tunes that are on my hard drive on my computer. They're not all completely finished or all, you know, something that I would want to play for somebody, but, you know, picking out those 12 was kind of challenging. So what I wanted to do is that there were a couple in particular that I wanted to put on the record. I wanted to put Zebediah Stomp on the record because I had written that tune in about 1992 when my nephew Zebediah was born. And it actually was recorded in 99 by this really great dobro player in Seattle named Orville Johnson. But I'd never had a chance to record it. And I just think it's a pretty fun little tune. And it was written at a time when I was really heavily influenced by Alan Mundy. And I think if you listen to the tune, you totally hear the Alan Mundy influence. In fact, one time I was playing at the Darrington Bluegrass Festival, and the Nashville Bluegrass Band was there, and Roland White was playing mandolin with
them. Oh, okay, go
and
ahead.
And a band I was...
This is
and,
this'll
a
be
band
good.
I was playing
this'll
with.
Be good. Go ahead.
Yeah, and so a band I was playing with was on stage, and we played that tune, and after we got off stage, Roland came up to me and introduced himself, which, of course, I know who he is.
Sure.
Really liked that tune, and I thought, well, that's really cool, and then years later, I was talking to John about it. He said, well, he probably liked it because it sounds just like Alan.
Something like Alan, because they were in Country Gazette forever. They did a lot of things together.
Oh, yeah.
One of my favorite early, I say early, in my interest in bluegrass was everything Country Gazette I could find. It was because of Alan, but also Roland. But that's a funny story that Roland would walk up. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. And, you know, in fact, John actually suggested to me that I should reach out to Roland and have a recorder. And I probably should have, but I kind of chickened out.
Oh, boy. They were my – at the time that I started playing, it's because of Alan and, of course, Banjo Sandwich and all that stuff. But then I would find every place where he was with Country Gazette. I couldn't get enough of it. So that's cool that they're rolling. Yeah.
That Banjo Sandwich record, you know, I mean, I was a die-hard Earl Scruggs fan, J.D. Crowe. I really liked Alan Shelton, but then when I heard, I can't remember how I heard about Alan Mundy, because, you know, this was back in pre-internet days.
Yeah.
And I grew up in Olympia, Washington, so there wasn't a huge scene there. I'm not quite sure how I found out about him, but I bought the Banjo Sandwich vinyl, and that just completely turned my head around. It's like, man, this is as good as Earl Scruggs, but it is totally different.
Mm-hmm. Did it make you want a Stelling? It wanted me to buy. Made me want to buy a Stelling because I thought that must be the magic. When really it was just Alan.
Yes.
But I had to have everything about it. Everything I had to have, and then I had to go back and get Poor Richard's Almanac, which preceded that, and that was Sam Bush, something that they did when they were much younger. And to me, Banjo Sandwich to me was, I don't know, that was the album of the 70s to me, and. It turned your head around and made you think about banjo. It made me think that I'd really better go to law school because I can never do that. And I've told Alan that. I said, you're the reason I went to law school. And I tell him why.
Oh, that's too funny. You know, he's such a generous guy. He's just a cool dude.
Yeah.
But his playing is just so, I probably mentioned it earlier, but his playing is just, there's not a wasted motion.
Nope.
I mean, it all is... You know, and I don't want to speak for him, but I have talked to him and read interviews where he has said that he's not really biggest improviser, and so he writes a lot of stuff and figures it all out. And man, it really shows because there's just so much attention to detail, and I really, really, really appreciate that about his playing.
And he takes Shelton's balance and just makes it glisten.
Oh, man.
He makes it glisten to me. Just, you know, that whole concept of that, where's that little extra note, and there, boom, there it is, and then he's up the... And by the way, no capos, Nick.
Yeah, I know. He played a show with Bill Evans
in
Victoria
in
about 5 years ago.
Yeah.
And, you know, I've seen Alan play and everything, but, you know, at that, I went to the show, and I was sitting in the front row, just like, man, this is... pretty amazing.
It's fun stuff, isn't it? Fun stuff. And Bill Evans is a very, very good friend of mine, and I say that with all sincerity. I talk about people being my friends, but Bill's friend from way, way back. So I love everything he thinks and everything he does. I want to get back to 30 or so because you and I could talk about these things forever, but and we can do that still sometime. But on 30 or so, the sixth cut is actually. A nice tune, but it's the name of, you say in French, I'm going to make you say it, but the record label is Ruby's Slipper. So talk a little bit about the sixth cut on the album, then I want you to maybe pick out one that we can end the show on.
Sure. So my previous record, 12 by 2 plus or minus 1, was released on the Corvus label, which is a label that John shares with a singer-songwriter from Canada named Susan Crowe. And for this album, I was going to release on the same label, but I thought, yeah, you know, I may never do this again, so I might as well do it on my label. So I went through all the paperwork and created a label called Ruby Slipper Records. And I had this tune, and I didn't have a name for it. And so I thought, well, you know, French is one of the official languages of Canada.
You're supposed to
and
know.
I don't speak French. My daughter speaks French because she's just so much smarter than me. And I thought it would be an interesting thing to just have just a slight nod to the French part of Canada. And so the Chanson de Ruby is Ruby Slipper, basically, in French. It's not a completely direct translation, but it's close enough.
That's close enough. The most upbeat, up-tempo song, I'll say, is the 12th cut, in my opinion, When the Black Dog Came Around. That one just kind of... There's another one. Cleo Bell's also pretty up-tempo. We talked about that a little bit. But When the Black Dog Comes Around is the final cut, and it kind of kicks off. Some of your stuff is so beautiful and without words so much, but ballads. I mean, we've talked about the nature of your writing and composing and playing, but the 12th song, to me, just I think you might have wanted to say, hey, this is, by the way, a banjo player playing a banjo album.
Well, you know, I really like listening to albums and how they're sequenced. I think that's very interesting. One of my favorite records is Avalon by Roxy Music.
Oh, cool. That's all right. Good. That's a good reference. I like that.
Yeah, and just, you know, the way that album is sequenced is just absolutely perfect. And John Reichman's album, Up in the Woods, is another album that's sequenced absolutely perfectly. So anyway, when I was putting this record together, I realized that a lot of the tunes are not breakdowns, which, you know, there's a lot of breakdowns out there, and there's a lot of other banjo players that could do that so much better than I could, so I don't even worry about it. So a lot of the tunes on the album are mid-tempo or even slow tunes. I'm thinking, I've got to sort of finish the album off with a bang, you know, to kind of wake people up, so get them ready to go get their car and drive home kind of thing. And so I thought that would be, you know, a good way to finish it. And one of the things that I tried to do on my first record, the 12 by 2, and on this one, is to try to set my tent poles pretty wide apart, you know, not just kind of do the same tune over and over again 12 times, but try to do different kinds of arrangements and different kinds of tunings and melodies and everything, just so that, you know, so that my statement, or for lack of a better word, is fairly broad instead of being narrow. And that tune is when the Black Dog Came Around. It's interesting because, interesting to me is that I wrote it as kind of an old-time fiddle tune. And then when I presented it to the other musicians on the cut, which is, we haven't mentioned the star of the album, that's Trent Freeman. He plays fiddle on everything.
Yeah. Beautiful string. There's beautiful string work on this.
Oh, man, he is. He's really an amazing young fiddle player. He plays in a band called The Fretless, which is like a string quartet here in Canada. They just won a Juno Award, which is the Canadian equivalent of a Grammy. And he's just a great, great fiddle player. So anyway, when I presented this tune to all the players, it kind of went in a direction that's decidedly not an old-time fiddle tune.
No.
And when we did it, I was like, man, this is actually really cool. I would never have thought of doing it this way. And it morphed. And I'm very happy with the way it turned out.
It's a good way to... I'm glad that you mentioned the fact that you think about sequencing. That's always something that's fascinated to me, and I like it when someone thinks this should follow this and this should end with this, so I appreciate that you added that in. I like the whole album, Nick. I think we should make this the the banjo sandwich of this coming decade. For all new players who want to be amazed, there's a little bit of everything for on there, and you can get a tablature book if you go to the Nick Hornbuckle website. You can do all those things that we used to do back in the 70s.
Well, Steve, you know, I mean, I really appreciate you saying that, but I'm going to have to go out and get me a bigger hat now.
Nick, so let you can choose the song that we end on when we say goodbye. We'll go into another cut from 30 or so for my guest Nick Hornbuckle, with a lot of great help from a lot of great musicians, and it's just a wonderful album. So we've talked about most of the cuts, touched on them a little bit. Tell me which one you'd like to go out on, and then I'll say goodbye, and we'll do that.
Okay, well, have we played Fleetwood's Ford yet?
No, we've talked about it, but we can certainly, it'd be a great way to end the show since we talked about Ivan.
Yeah, maybe do that one, because, you know, I mean, his playing is just...
Oh, it's stellar.
So, it's really great. I'm not very good with the synonyms. I keep saying great and amazing, but I don't know what else to say, because that's what it is.
He's very tasteful and a lot of talent.
Yes, very much.
That's the best way I can describe it. Nick, man, thanks. It's been a pleasure. I'm so glad we finally had a chance to chat. I don't get to British Columbia very often, so we had to do it by phone. Maybe someday we'll run across each other in physical presence and chat and do a follow-up to this. But the 30 or so album, I'm absolutely enthralled with. Thank you for sending it, and thanks for being available to Unreal Bluegrass, Nick Hornbuckle, to talk about it. I've enjoyed it immensely.
Great. Thanks, Steve. And I also want to say one quick little thing is that I really like your slogan, Pit Peace.
That's oh, good. How can you not? And you let people, I appreciate that very much, but some people say, well, I don't know what that means. So that means whatever you want, but shouldn't it be an uplifting thing to pick peace? Shouldn't it be something that you play
Absolutely.
Music to make people happy, or you choose peace? And I just figure it's so amorphous it can mean anything, but I appreciate that. I do appreciate that. All right.
Yeah, well, that's one of the things that really struck me about you and your show is that kind of encapsulates it right there.
Thank you, man. Nick Hornbuckle, it's a blast, man. We'll get together. I promise we'll get together. I'll try to catch up to you somewhere, and when we do, we'll sit and chat again, maybe for the show, maybe just to catch up a little bit.
That sounds great. Thanks, Steve.
Thanks, Nick. See you. Bye.